He says at one point, somebody has to be the 70th best golfer in the world. Why not me?
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
At the beginning of the school year, he had buried a quart jar of pennies underneath his house. He drew a treasure map so he could find them again. A week later, his mom cleaned out his room and threw away the map. Vern had been trying to find those pennies for 9 months. 9 months, man. He didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
Hey, hello, everybody.
Hi, it is everybody.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. It is episode 54 of Recotopia. I'm Chris Atkinson.
And I'm Jeremy Scott.
And today's big recommend will be Stand By Me, an excellent choice by Jeremy. And we'd once again like to welcome all of you who are watching us on a Tuesday in chat on Twitch and YouTube. Thank you guys for coming out and watching us talk about movies and such. Sometimes ingredients and things that you can get at grocery stores and things like that. We talk about that. And sometimes, probably, if you're listening to the outtakes, things about traffic. all right. So, Jeremy, do you have any small recommends for us?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Dude, I am overflowing with small recommends, and I'm going to keep it at two, but I've got some stored up for next week. My first small recommend is a new Netflix television show. It's called Full Swing, and it is about professional golfers on the PGA Tour, and it's made by the folks that made the Formula One show Drive to Survive. Drive to Survive is the show that my brother started watching with no Formula One knowledge, and now he is a Formula One freak. when he came to my house for a weekend, he got up super freaking early to watch a Formula One race, and I was mind blown. But he's super into it now. And so when I found out those same people were making a show about golf, I thought, there has never been a show more up my alley. Now, that's not necessarily true. I have a lot to say about this show, but I'm going to try to keep it short. This show is made for people who are like my brother was to Formula One, who don't watch golf and maybe don't know anybody besides the biggest handful of names. I watch every single round of every single golf tournament that's broadcast, and so there is a lot of these episodes that is tournament footage that I have already seen before. Many times I know exactly the shot that's going to be made and exactly who's going to win. So it's weird for me to be a little bored by those parts of the show, but then really enthralled by all the behind the scenes and interview stuff that they throw in along the way. And they're telling really interesting stories. The best episode is the fourth one. It's about a golfer named Joel Damon, who is unknown and is just one of the most self-deprecating, coolest, chillest dudes. I didn't know who he was much before this show. He says at one point, somebody has to be the 70th best golfer in the world. Why not me? So I am recommending the show in the hopes that more and more people will check it out and get hooked on golf and start watching golf. I know three people that have started watching this show that have already expressed an interest in watching upcoming golf tournaments that had never really been golf watchers before. So I'm very much hoping this does for the PGA what Drive to Survive did for Formula One, which is kind of make it mainstream. There's just a lot of really interesting behind-the-scenes stuff. Some of these guys are clearly not coached. Say things that I'm not sure they wish they'd said. But anyway, Full Swing is on Netflix. It's about 45 minutes an episode, 8 episodes in the season. I'm almost positive they're going to pick it up for a second season. But there you go. That's my first small recommend.
Yeah, I have just enough interest in golf to watch this, I think. it's interesting when over the course of a year, you know, Jonathan and I will sit there and talk about baseball. We'll watch games not involving our teams and things like that, right, and all that type of stuff. And so we have this, like, you know, this sort of this incredible knowledge of baseball, not as much as some people, but like more than the average person. But then Jeremy, like, every weekend there's a golf tournament. He's like, there's this golf tournament and it's super close and there's blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, what is this? It's the Pan Am Handshake Open or something. And you're just like, and you're like, okay, like, I've never heard of this, but oh, it's close. Okay, I may watch that then, you know, because sometimes, you know, on a Sunday, yeah, it's that dead zone of 5 to 6 o'clock or whatever. You want to watch something kind of compelling or whatever.
Oh, but man,
also, yeah. So Jeremy watches all these damn tournaments. It's amazing. Yep. So, all right. So, catching up on all the Oscar nominees and things like that, I watched a movie called After Sun.
Ooh. Which,
has Paul Mescal is the nominee here for I think it's supporting actor. This movie is got a pretty high. It's like 7.7 on the IMDb, and, like, you know, I hadn't heard much about it. And so I watched it, and it's one of these movies, by the end of it, I was like, I don't know if I like this movie. I don't know if I like this. I'm feeling kind of curmudgeonly about this movie. And then I started just thinking about it. And by the end of it, I was like, oh, this movie's really good now that I think about it. It's really good. It really fooled, like, it not fooled me, but it pulled the wool over my eyes or whatever in a way that was like, it's hard to describe, really, but it focuses on this girl named Sophie, played by Frankie Corio, who is on vacation with her dad, and we only get snippets of things about her dad and what, you know, and her mom and things like that, like what's going on with him. It's all from her perspective. So if you keep that in mind, you're going to be frustratingly missing a lot of things, because it feels like you should know more about this man that she's this her father as it goes along. But if you're watching it from a child's eyes, it really does, like, sort of, you know, it sort of makes sense by the end of it. But it's a vacation that they're taking, and they're hanging out, they have fun, they have their moments where things, you know, aren't so fun. Every once in a while, you know, she'll whip out a camera and she'll be shooting him, and he's doing something, and, like, you know, it catches some moments where you're like, if you interpret it just a certain way, you'd be like, oh, okay, so this guy's really depressed, isn't he? He's really depressed, and it doesn't really come full circle. Like, you don't really notice for a while. And meanwhile, there's this sort of all this intercutting all the way through it, where an adult Sophie is going through a dance floor, and it's strobe lights, and it's just sitting there, like, doing this. Now, I'll give you a trigger warning about that, because that strobe light stuff I was like, my God, I can only imagine, you know, what epileptic people, right, might be thinking about watching a movie like this. But she's wanting to go through this dance floor, and she's approaching a figure you don't quite know who it is. And then as it gets closer and closer, you're realizing it's her dad, but you don't know if that's, like, in the future, or if it's in her mind, or if it's, like, you know, a whole bunch of stuff going on in there. But it's really just sort of a coming of age story with some sort of, like, hints at what's going on with the father. And the movie is, doesn't really, like, give you any easy answers. And by the end of it, I felt like I think a lot of times people use the word haunting maybe a little bit too much when they're talking about certain movies or whatever, but this one really does truly feel like a haunting experience by the time the movie's over. And it has an incredible final shot that will have you talking for a while about what it meant and how much impact it has. It's hard to really describe what's going on. It's really just, you know, it's, they're at a vacation resort and she's doing vacation-y things. She's on, she's in the pool. She's meeting her first boyfriend, quote unquote. She's hanging out with the older kids who are obviously doing things more advanced than she is. It occasionally goes to the future and it goes to the adult Sophie, and she's in, and shows her life now, and she's about to have a birthday, and it's really sort of how her birthday is triggering her memories of back then when her father was having the birthday around the same age. And one of those movies I seriously didn't know if I liked it for a long time, and then finally just came up onto the thing that it's a haunting, just a really well done experience. I highly recommend this, Jeremy. I think that you will like this. I will say that all through this, you, because of the way this movie's presentation is, you are constantly going to think that something bad is going to happen to her father. And I won't reveal whether or not something bad happens to him. I will say that if something bad does happen, you will not see it on screen. So it is a highly recommended movie. I think you may really love this, actually. Well, and you might have the same feelings as I did watching it.
Well, I'm almost positive I can buy this to watch on Amazon, because I flip through there every weekend to see what new early access movies, you know, you can pay like $20 to watch at home instead of the theater. I think this is one of those. And it's definitely one of the ones I've paused on and go, should I watch this? Should I watch this? No, I'll just watch Hunt for October again. but again, I'll bump this up the list.
if you're looking for like lots of like crackling dialogue and just amazing, exciting events, you're not going to get that. But I've seen a lot of movies like this recently where there's not really the point is to show a slice of life and it's sort of like a very matter of fact way of presenting it. And a lot of times I feel real cold afterwards. This one, I just didn't feel that. This is one of those movies that really makes you think afterwards, about what you just saw and what it all meant. And really enjoyed it. So,
speaking of something that stays with you and makes you think, my next small recommend is an HBO documentary called All That Breathes. I believe this is nominated for some awards. It won some festival awards. Here we go. Nominated for an Academy Award in a documentary category. I'm already telling people, friends, that this is the Roma of documentaries. And it's kind of funny because there's even a plane going overhead reflected in a puddle in this movie, which happens in Roma. But that's not why I'm calling this the Roma of documentaries. This is about two brothers who are doing all they can to help injured and sick kites. This takes place in Delhi in India. Kites are a bird of prey that's common there. And in Muslim belief, feeding kites helps expel troubles. And so these boys grew up seeing their relatives, you know, throw meat up to the kites to feed them. They appear to be, throughout this movie, as common as seagulls on the coast. They're everywhere. And these two guys, out of their own little business, where the way they make money is they make soap dispensers, but they use almost all the profits to bring in these injured and sick birds. And the community has slowly begun to realize you can bring these birds to these guys and they'll, you know, set a broken bone or heal a cut and sew it up. And they basically are just, that's their thing. That's what they do. And this movie is so fucking beautiful. I almost don't want to say any more about it, except that I've been spending so much time the last day and a half thinking about my own life. What will my legacy be, and how important is that even? And the movie has a lot to say about this, as far as the temporariness of us. And, you know, Delhi is falling apart around them, both in terms of riots and the world's biggest landfill, and the air is becoming unbreathable for both the kites and the humans. The camera work is gorgeous. I'm so in love with this movie. I want everyone I know to see it. And I think there's even a part near the end where he says, all of life is important, and we're a community of air. That's what he says. And I just, you know, these characters, it feels like a movie. It's a documentary. Mm-hmm. These men even discuss at one point, you know, once we're dead, no one's going to pick up the slack. No one's going to be helping the kites, but it's still important that we are doing it. I don't know. I'm tripping over my words. I wish that I'd waited a week to recommend this so I could be more eloquent. This movie has smacked me in the heart. I love movies like this. So, anyway, it's on HBO Max. It's called All That Breathes. Watch the trailer. The trailer gave me a hint of that. And if the trailer moves you, then I think the movie will as well. So there you go.
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah. Second okay. Moment. Well, I'm definitely going to watch this when I get a chance. I do love movies like this. So
it is okay for kids. I see Shaggy Nuts 78 asking. It is okay for kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got to assure the guy, the person named Shaggy Nuts, that it's okay with kids. you know, it's funny. We've just two in a row. We've done like so movies that are just like this super meaningful and like you know, kind of out of body experiences, and then we're gonna end it on my last small recommend, which is Thunderbolt and Lightfoot.
Okay.
From 1974.
Super deep thoughts about humanity here.
Talk about whiplash. Well. I mean, it does have its moments, but it, thinking about life, but it's not like quite like what we just went through here. But Thunderbolt and Lightfoot was directed by Michael Cimino. I believe it was his feature debut. And it came out before The Deer Hunter and everything. And it stars Clint Eastwood and Jeff Bridges. In the 70s is a wonder to behold. Like, we love him now for all of his old curmudgeon-y type of roles that he's done, but watching him in the 70s as a young man is a fun sight. But the movie begins with we see Clint Eastwood as a preacher at this small church. I believe they're in Idaho at the beginning of this movie, and a man comes into the church and starts shooting at him. And Eastwood runs out and gets chased down by this man. Happening at the same time, Jeff Bridges has gone to a car dealership and gets into this Trans Am, and the dealer is like doing his full on car salesman shtick. Bridges is giving him, you know, giving him some idle chatter back. And dealer's like, yeah, man, just go ahead and rev her on up, see what you feel about her, and blah, 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 and all that. Of course, Bridges revs her up, and then all in the ruse to take off in the car and steal it. As he is absconding with this Trans Am, he ends up running into the situation where Eastwood is running away from this man, and Bridges actually hits the dude that is chasing Eastwood. Eastwood ends up getting in the car with him. And they sort of strike this unusual friendship at the very beginning. It's not, of course, it's not like immediate or anything, but Eastwood is hurt. They go out into the woods. He does something to like pop his shoulder back in or something like that. Hmm. And Jeff Bridges says, you're definitely not a preacher. You're not like you've had a life, right? You find out about Eastwood and that he was a guy who stole from this, this place called the Montana Armored. And he stole $500,000 with his buddies and hid it behind a chalkboard in a one room schoolhouse. And because of some misunderstandings of what happened after the money was stolen, now all of his former partners want to kill him. And that's what's going on. And one of those partners that wants to kill him is played by George Kennedy, who ends up after trying to kill him. They all decide, all he and his partner who were trying to kill Eastwood have this sort of agreement where they're like, you know what, why don't we go and just steal from Montana Armored again and just and get the money. So obviously a lot of things have to happen for them to get into that state of mind. But one of them is that they go to is that Eastwood goes to the, where he, where the one room schoolhouse is and finds out that it is now a full-fledged elementary school and that, that there's no way that they would be able to get that money now, or it's been found and no one has said anything about it or whatever. So the hopes of getting $500,000 are dashed. They decide to steal from Montana Armored again. And so the whole thing after this is a big sort of a heist movie. Hmm. At this point, and what happens with that, and it, you know, they got all the classic things of heist movies are in here. The plan, you know, what are they going to do in the plan? How are they going to execute it? And then, of course, you know, if you've ever seen a heist movie, that the plan doesn't always, you know, doesn't always work out. And then there's plenty of surprises left in store for this movie. It's really you just watching Eastwood and Bridges and George Kennedy and all these guys interact with each other. And it's a whole lot of fun. These 1970s movies back in the day, you know, just, I don't know, just had a spirit about them. Obviously there are some moments, not too many, like you're not too many moments. You go, oh, you, that's the '70s. All right. But there's quite a few moments that don't play well today in this movie, but, it's a whole lot of fun. This movie's a whole lot of fun. So, I would highly recommend this one. So there you go.
You've been on a bit of an Eastwood tear off and on here,
yeah,
right?
Kind of. And Eastwood has probably one of my favorite facial expressions ever in this movie. There's a scene where Bridges takes two women back to their hotel room. And Bridges is like, you know, well, this one's yours and then this one's mine or whatever. And then he goes off into another room. And Eastwood doesn't look like he's wanting to be any part of this, but the next scene is like this woman is on top of him and they're having sex and she seems to be enjoying it, and it shows her and then it cuts to Eastwood, and Eastwood's got this look on his face like it's kind of this like, I don't even know, I can't even enjoy this. And it's one of the best it's one of the best expressions ever, just to see Eastwood doing that. Anyway, there you go. That's a fun movie. And all right, I guess all it's right. Time for the big recommend.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Oh, after that, the big recommend is Stand By Me. Rob Reiner believes this to be the best film he ever made. I had not seen this, even though this was my recommend this week. I had not seen it in years and years. And boy, oh boy, am I glad I recommended this movie. Mm-hmm. Hot damn. Other than a few slurs, what would be considered slurs now, that weren't at the time the film was made. It doesn't feel dated to me. It still gave me all the coming of age feels that a coming of age movie ought to give. And I was struck this time out by the child performers. Who I think are maybe a little too young to be this good. I read behind the scenes on IMDb that Sean Astin auditioned to play the role of Chris, and he went immediately after River Phoenix. And when he walked in the room, he knew instantly he wasn't going to get the part because everyone was crying and all emotional. And he knew that River Phoenix had nailed it. This is some really fine acting from four young men, one who is sadly gone. This is a story, a fairly simple story. One of a group of four friends is underneath the porch digging for pennies, as you do. And he had buried the pennies under there and then forgot where they were. Overhears his older brother and another gang member talking about a dead body that they'd spotted. And they decide not to tell the rest of the gang or the police because they had stolen a car and they don't want to really have to talk to the police for any reason, let alone maybe get caught for having stolen this car. So then it's Vern, I think, is the younger brother who's under the under the porch. And he goes to the clubhouse and tells the other three friends, hey, what if we did an adventure? What if we all told our parents we're going to do a camp out in my backyard? And then what if we went and looked for this dead body? There's this kid in their town about their age who's been missing for like 3 days, I think, at this point. And that's who the dead body is. And so they decide to do this plan. They decide to go on a big-ass hike for miles and miles along the train tracks to find this dead body, which is supposedly near the train tracks, because they want to be in the newspaper as the people who discovered the dead body. Actually, everybody who's looking for the body in this movie, their motivation is fame, basically. Just speaks of the era, I guess. But they're like, we'll get our picture in the paper for finding this dead body. So the first real dust-up along the way is when Teddy wants to dodge a train, which is, I guess, you stay on the tracks until the last minute and then you jump off. Which, again, I didn't grow up quite in that era. So it's not something my friends and I ever tried to do. But Chris pulls him off, and then there's a big fight. And one of my favorite things about this movie is how often they fight, because I feel like that's really true to 12-year-old friendships. They are also in equal measure incredibly supporting of each other throughout at various times. And I just think it's a very real portrait of that age. You're not quite a teenager. They even say at the end, see you in junior high. But you're not really a kid anymore. And so, you know, you're insecure. So you pick on even your friends. They end up chilling at a junkyard because they need to get some more water. And looks to me like they're just dodging the sun for a little bit. And they do this contest, and they make Will Wheaton go get the food while everybody stays there in the shade. They have $2.37 to spend, which is a number Stephen King seems to like. And I read on IMDb that's the purchasing power of $21 in 2021. So that it makes sense that they're able to buy hamburgers and buns and stuff for all. When he gets back, though, to the junkyard, everybody's gone. And he turns right at the last moment to see the junkyard man, the junk man, I don't know. And he says, hey, you. And he starts running and he sees his friends are already climbing over the fence to get away. And there's this legend of the dog that guards this junkyard, Chopper. And that the guy will yell, sick balls, and the dog will come and chew your balls off. And so Will Wheaton runs the daylights out of himself trying to get away from this dog. And he just barely makes it, only to hop over the fence and turn around to see just a goofy ass mutt. Like, no dog to really be worried about there. Probably would have let you pet him. So then the junk man is really, really, really extraordinarily mean to Teddy. Teddy's father has mental health issues and is in a hospital for that. And the junk man just cruelly taunts Teddy for his dad being insane. And Teddy wants to climb back over and fight this grown man. And then as they finally pull him away and walk away, you know, Teddy breaks down. Interesting. I just love this movie, the way that everybody kind of gets a moment to feel loss and be vulnerable in front of their friends. And they are so supportive in this moment. They're like, fuck that guy. Your dad stormed the beaches at Normandy. That guy didn't. And then they come to what is probably the most famous scene in the movie, the big, tall train bridge that's 100 feet up in the air over water. And they debate whether to cross the train bridge or go down the mountain and go around. And Teddy says, well, you guys can go around. I'll be waiting for you over there. I'm walking across. And so they're like, well, I'm not going to be a chicken too. So they all walk across. And sure enough, a train comes before they are all the way across. And Jerry O'Connell's Vern character has been crawling on his hands and knees. And when they seize the train, he at first tries to just do that faster. And Will Wheaton has to come and drag him up and say, no, you have to run. And they, of course, barely jump off the last bit of tracks before the train comes through. And I think that jump probably should kill both of those children when you finally see where they are, because there's giant ass rocks. And they go, they easily jumped 20 feet down and there's rocks everywhere. But hey, this is, you know, sort of a, I don't know, I feel like this is almost kind of like a mythical kind of tale, like a Homer Odyssey kind of thing. Anyway, at the campfire that night, they asked Gordy to tell him a story, because Gordy's, of course, a writer and a really, really good one. It wouldn't be a Stephen King story if there wasn't a writer in it. And he tells the story of the grossest scene in the movie, a pie-eating contest, where a large boy who is tired of being picked on intentionally poisons himself so that midway through a pie-eating contest, he will vomit gargantuanly and hopefully get his justice on everybody who's made fun of him by making them vomit as well. I remember when I was younger, I could not watch this scene. It plays a lot more comically to me today than it did, you know, when I was in my teens. And you know, it's a, I think it's a funny little story. And then of course his friends criticize the ending, which is, I think, an in-joke about Stephen King's stories having endings that are weird.
Specifically, Vern does. Vern is the one who, or is it Vern?
It's Feldman. It's Teddy.
Teddy, the Teddy that criticizes the ending. It's just like, and he says, which shows you what's on his mind. Why didn't he go home and kill his father and then join the National Guard or something like that? I'm like, Jesus Christ, Teddy.
Well, Teddy's been through some shit. I mean, honestly, all these kids have. Vern gets made fun of for being fat. He doesn't really look very fat in this movie, but that's, you know, a measure of obesity in the 80s wasn't as bad as it is today. And you know, Chris is he's part of the bad family in town, and no one ever expects that he's gonna do any good. Teddy's father is gone, and Will Wheaton's dad is a zombie because his Will Wheaton's older brother has recently died in a car accident. And so John Cusack, I forgot that entirely, that he played the older brother in flashbacks. I love the campfire night because we get that story and we get the fun, and then they do their smokes and all that stuff. But then they have to stand watch because they hear coyotes. And, you know, that provides this moment for Will Wheaton and Chris, where Chris breaks down about feeling worthless, like no one's ever going to think he can amount to anything.
What I'm guessing is the audition scene, too, because that's.
It might be that IMDb says that Rob Reiner thought he could do better. And so he asked him to do a take where he specifically thought about an adult that had let him down. And that is the take that ended up in the final cut. It's just incredible acting. Just like, it's like 12 years old. These people are doing tradecraft with acting like leaps and bounds beyond anything I ever did. Anyway, they, the gang finally finds out about the body. This is Kiefer Sutherland's lead gang. And they also want to go find the body so they can get their picture in the paper. Mm-hmm. The kids do get there first. And it's not an adventure anymore. I think all affected by it. There's this great pause where I kept wondering, how long is he going to let this pause go? Because right when they see the body and nobody says anything, and it's clear they're all going, why did we do this?
Yeah.
This is not cool. I'm freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
But the gang shows up before really anything else can happen. Of course, as happens throughout the movie, old adults threaten to beat up these young kids. Will Wheaton has to pull out the gun, the Chekhov's gun that River Phoenix brought along, fire it into the air and scare off the gang members. I'm pretty sure in a few days, Kiefer Sutherland's going to stab the shit out of that kid. but for today, they win the day and they go home and they're all clearly changed by this experience. And then we go back out to the Richard Dreyfuss writer who opened us up, finishing up this story he's writing. And then he goes off to play with his kids. I have a few other things to say, but I adored this movie this time through. I'm interested to see what your experience was like.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those that I feel like I've seen 100 times, but I probably only seen it all the way through 3 times after this. But it's one of these that used to come on cable a lot, and they used to watch certain scenes, and especially the campfire thing where they're talking about what the hell is Goofy. And
yeah,
and I love how they just intercut the Goofy debate with all these other little thoughts that they have, like, you know, like there's a great line in there where Will Wheaton says, I always knew the $64,000 question was rigged. How could anybody know that much about operas? You know, and then just intercutting with other people, like, Goofy's a dog. He's definitely a dog. And it's like, but he drives around in a car and he goes to work. It's huge debates about that. You see the kind of actor I believe River Phoenix was going to become. You know, you and I have our favorites that he's in and in his short life. I mean, Last Crusade, he's in that just very briefly. Sneakers, of course, is great. And then his last movie was shot here in Nashville. The Thing Called Love was just before he died. He was going to be. I often wonder. This is one of the biggest what ifs for me. How big does Leonardo DiCaprio get if River Phoenix doesn't die? Because
at least that big, right?
I think so. He was definitely on the track to be that. But who knows? I mean, he could also just become a character actor and we're just like, oh, we love that River Phoenix, you know, whatever. But he was definitely a heartthrob guy who was who had a lot of talent. So you can see that in this movie. And I think he's slightly older than all the kids here. I think they shot this in 1985 and he's 15. Whereas like Jerry O'Connell's 11. And you know, they have ages in between, but it's clear he's old. He's got that authority presence among these four kids. Not only the kids in the movie, like he's obviously the leader, no doubt about it. But he's also probably the leader of this acting crew too. Like, you know, so I was really impressed with him, and especially a lot of the scenes where it shows him, you know, especially when he's talking to Will Wheaton, who they're the best friends out of this four group. Every time Will Wheaton starts thinking like, you know, bad, like he's worthless and all that, he's like, that's your dad talking, man. That's bullshit. You know, don't, you know, it's like, you wrote that story and it was great. And he's sort of become what John Cusack was, is his yeah. his brother was. His brother was so supportive of him. There's that great scene too where he's there around the dinner table, and everybody wants to talk about how, you know, he was awesome in this football game and everything. And Benny's like, "Did you read Gordy's story? It was great." Yeah. And all these guys, their parents are just like, nah, don't want to talk about it. And he's like, and then he turns to him. He's like, that was a great story though. It was a really good story. Yeah. You know, he was the only support system. And once he dies, these yeah. parents, you know, that this is I don't know how common this is. I'm not, but these parents have just completely shut off. They don't care about what Gordy feels at all. Like, he's non-existent to them at this point. And it's really sad, but it's a very Stephen King thing to have these kind of parents in his yeah. stories. And it's interesting to me always too, when I see this guy, it's Marshall Bell who plays his dad. As soon as I see him, I think he's dude, the Stephen, what's his name? God, maybe you know what I'm talking about. I have to look him up.
Dublowski?
He's Dublowski, yes. this would be really good radio. I've got to look it up, but it's... I always think he's Stephen Collins when I first see him.
Oh, okay.
Because his eyes are similar, the facial yeah. features are similar, and you've seen Marshall Bell in a bunch of stuff, but it takes me like a 5-second learning curve to realize it's not Stephen Collins. And then his mom is the mom and from Back to the Future, is Lorraine's mom in Back yep. to the Future.
Yep.
But yeah, just seeing them when he's asking about where his canteen is or whatever out from the window, and they're just doing this like mindless tasks and not even like paying attention to him and everything. You really feel for this kid.
Yep.
And you don't feel like he's in a physically abusive situation. I mean, he's certainly in an emotionally abusive situation mm-hmm. there. And he seems like he might have a better life than these other three kids, but the other three kids, you know, as much as their home lives are bad too. You know, he's suffering just as much as they are
yeah.
in a lot of ways. And it's really sad too. Of course, when you watch the Alex Winter documentary about kid actors and stuff like that, like I think nearly every one of these kids, like, I don't know about Jerry O'Connell, but nearly every one of these kids had similar backgrounds to what the characters they're actually playing.
Yes.
So Corey Feldman said this was as close to anything that he'd ever played to his real life, apparently. Wow. So but yeah, this movie is you know, it's kind of like the body is kind of a MacGuffin really in this thing. It's really yeah. just a means for which they go on this adventure. I think someone was in the comments said, what about the leeches? And like, yeah, that's a scary moment when they go through the water and they come out and there's all these leeches. And of course, Gordy looks down in his underwear and he notices one that's latched on into another place. Yeah. And, the funny thing about that I read was that they didn't want to put them in real water because they didn't know they didn't want to put the kids in real water because they didn't know what was in the water, but they ended up making this pool for them that sat around for 3 months yeah. apparently. So like, it was still mystery water when they went in it.
I love that beat where he uses the stick. He goes, it's not that deep. We can walk across. And they go, one, oh, yeah. two, flunk. They all fall straight down into the water. It's such a funny comedic beat.
Yeah. The thing that they talk about, the pie eating contest, I think a lot of times if you watch this on the first go round, you're like, wait a minute, this guy's supposed to be some amazing writer. This is a pie eating contest where everybody throws up on each other. How does that forecast into somebody great? And it's like, the kid is 12 years old, man.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to write about. They're going to write about poop and farts and all sorts and people vomiting on each other. And it's a great story. It's a great revenge story if you throw out some of the, I mean, the silliness is part of it, but like, it's a great revenge story when you think about it. This guy is constantly hounded for being a lard ass. People always are just like yelling that at him and everything. And then he gets his full on revenge by like drinking a whole thing of castor oil, which is the grossest part of them. I think drinking the whole castor oil is the grossest part of that story.
He cracks a single egg into his mouth. I don't think it's an accident that the protagonist in this story is somebody who is downtrodden and picked on, and you know, because that's the perspective Gory would write from, and that's the kind of perspective all these kids would relate to. I love that bit you mentioned where Chris is basically trying to lift Gordy's spirits by saying, "You're an awesome writer, man. You're going to go out there and do great stuff and get out of this town." It reminded me so much of when Ben Affleck confronts Will in Good Will Hunting and says, "You know, I could keep waiting for you to wake up and realize what a gift you've been given. And so I can show up here and you'll be gone. And I know you're finally living your real life." I'm very moved by these kids, their acting and how supportive they were to each other, because it just felt real. I feel like I had friendships at 12, and then of course the whole thing ends with, you know, I never had any friends as good as I did when I was 12. Jesus, does anyone?
Yeah.
I think that's part of why the film works, because he even says people drift out of your life. You know, these two, you know, Vern and Teddy drifted out of their lives after a couple more years and just became bodies they passed in the hall at school. But for this 1 2-day period in this one summer, they were as tight as could be.
Castro says, quotes in the movie, "You could even write about us if you're hard up for material." And it's funny to think about this, because Richard Dreyfuss is playing the older Gordy in this, to think about, like, when he's writing the story that you're loving every minute of watching Stand By Me and everything. And then by the end of it, you're thinking, "Whoa, is he hard up for material? Is he finally he's finally writing about the friends? Is this what this means? Was he in a writer's block for a while there before he finally started writing about this?" And then, you know, of course it's a super sad the movie where, you know, everybody has these friends. Like, it's amazing to think about, like, how you're like those kids who were your friends, that's all you hung out with them every day. And then suddenly you go to a school and go to different schools or something like that, and you don't ever see them again. Mm-hmm. And like he says, he's like, you're just had faces you pass in the halls. And it's like, yeah, that's exactly how it goes. I mean, I know plenty of people I knew back in that day where by high school, you're like, "Oh yeah. I used to hang out with those kids." Yeah. Like, I don't anymore. Don't have anything in common really with them anymore. By the end of it, we find out that Chris, takes college courses and he ends up being a lawyer, and then he ends up trying to break a fight. And this is something that I stumbled across on the IMDb trivia that I didn't really give much thought to, but he, in that scene where they're at the body, Kiefer Sutherland's about to cut his throat.
Yeah.
And he gets stopped, but that's exactly how he ends up dying.
Yeah.
Is by trying to stop a fight and somebody's got a knife and he stabs him in the throat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, a really sad ending, but it's just so true to life. And a really well done movie. Rob Reiner, again, could not do any wrong in this period of time.
I will say somebody who did wrong was whoever wrote the fucking captions for this movie, because those are some of the worst closed captions I've ever seen.
Anything that's in this era, you know, anything that's before probably like 2010. Is going to be like this. But now, because of kids are actually turning on subtitles for things, because the way things are mixed these days. And I'm glad that I'm not crazy, because I used to think that it was just my hearing is going bad. I'm getting older, but like the way they mix things makes it hard to understand stuff a lot of times. Like, why can I watch this one thing and I can hear voices clearly and I honestly can't hear it anymore? But like, they've started doing these like amazing subtitles, and it got a bunch of play when Stranger Things that last season came out because people were turning on the subtitles and getting entertained by the subtitles.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. All right.
But well, yeah, but the now, I mean, yeah, in the '80s, terrible. They're always going to be terrible.
I am curious to see what you've chosen for our super secret double feature for today.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Man, there's so many things that came up on this one. And I think no matter what I come up with, it's going to be like, ah, yeah, that makes sense. You know, like, I mean, there's really like not anything that I could come up with as far as an offbeat double feature.
Right.
One that I thought of was It Chapter One because of the Stephen King connection, the kids mm-hmm. connection.
Mm-hmm.
That one seemed like a good one. American Graffiti, I think really just because of the era in which it's in, it was another one that I thought of. Then there was, I think there was another one. I can't remember, but I'm going to go with the Goonies on this.
Yes! You're the man.
The Goonies is a perfect compliment to this. Kids on an adventure, just sort of has that same feel. Goonies came out just a year before this movie came out. Corey Feldman is also in the Goonies. And of course, see, we had that Sean Astin story about, him going in after River Phoenix. Sean Astin is in this movie. I am sure a lot of these actors here probably tried out for the Goonies too.
Yep.
It's a perfectly, perfectly good compliment to this whole thing. So that's what I'm going to go with.
Nice. I applaud that choice. You're right, because I like to try and predict what your double feature will be, but I immediately had like seven ideas, and I was like, yeah, there's so many movies that will work here, and there's really not, like, I saw somebody in the chat say, I got to scroll up and see what it was, Sleepers, and I'm like, oh, fuck, don't choose Sleepers.
Yeah.
But I understand why Sleepers was thrown out, but would be too big of a shift, I think.
And another one that was thrown out that would have been really good is Sandlot, especially since Sandlot has a similar legendary dog that will kill you story in it. So the Sandlot would be an amazing compliment to this as well.
Make it a triple feature, quadruple feature.
Yeah, exactly. So
anyway. All right. So let's talk about homework for next week.
So a few weeks ago, I was like, I want to recommend this one movie, but I can't find it streaming anywhere. Guess what? Just suddenly started streaming.
Yeah. What?
Strange Days.
Oh, wow. I saw this movie in the theater, and that's the only time I've ever seen it. All I remember was that it was trippy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm guessing you've seen it more recently.
I have. I had to order this like a special Blu-ray that's region specific to watch it.
Of course it is.
But anyway, yes, I've seen this recently. So do want to mention a couple of things. There are some triggering moments in this movie as well. There is rape. I would say it's graphic enough to be very disturbing. And then there is a suicide that happens towards the end. I think you will know who that person is when they're about to do it. It is pretty quick, though.
Okay.
I don't think it's graphic, but it is enough to be like, oh shit, that's it's going to be like that. So there's that. Anyway, Ralph Fiennes is in this. Angela Bassett, Tom Sizemore again. We got Tom Sizemore, who was in everything, I think, in the mid-90s. It's got Vincent D'Onofrio and William Fichtner in it as a couple of cops, and Glenn Plummer plays a rapper who has been killed by the cops in this. And James Cameron apparently came up with this story, came up with the basic story for Strange Days in the 80s. But then when they were shooting Terminator 2, that's when the Rodney King beating happened. And apparently it happened right around the corner from where they were filming some stuff, or close by or something like that. So James Cameron ended up writing a lot of this, and it ends up being directed by his then wife, Catherine Bigelow, who has, of course, has a tremendous filmography that I think we're after the Hurt Locker, everybody sort of like started going back and like, oh wow, Catherine Bigelow is pretty fucking awesome. Didn't fucking realize this. And Strange Days is a movie just like, you know, you said you saw it back in 1995 and that was the end of it. Same here. But I had caught some parts of it recently, and my sci-fi loving brain really has grown to appreciate this movie over the years. And it's just one of these, it's going to have some moments where you're like, wow, this movie kind of predicted a lot of things that have happened. And is also aware of things that were happening that we were in the dark about. But it's an odd thing, because it's a 1995 movie that's in the future, the distant future of 1999. and it's about these headsets that can capture not only video of what you're watching, but capture what you're feeling. And then it records all of that, and people can buy that, and they can feel what the person felt while they were watching the videos. And that's what Ray Fiennes is going around selling this type of stuff. So that is the movie for next week. I can't wait to talk about it, because it's a movie that doesn't get talked about very much these days. It's a movie that hasn't had much streaming capabilities, and it just got on HBO Max. So I'm really, really, really excited about a new audience watching this. I had a lot of things in the queue there, and I was gonna name a bunch of movies there, but Strange Days, let's get it while it's hot. Let's get it while we can.
And it's HBO Max, correct? Is that where it's at?
Yep.
And I have a dozen movies that aren't streaming anywhere that I check every few weeks, and once they pop on streaming, they're gonna go up to the top of my recommend list. But yeah, I'll be curious to go back to this. I literally only remembered that it was set in the future, and I remember feeling like it was trippy. So I'm looking forward to experiencing it as my now self. All right, I think we got time for one question.
All right.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
And we'll do this first one. What movies are you looking forward to this year?
Let me get to my list, this is fun. This is fun when I have my list up and then just suddenly the thing starts to. All right. So the ones that the new Mission Impossible movie. Ooh, is one that I want to watch. I want to watch Oppenheimer, because it's Christopher Nolan, and Spider-Man Across the Universe. I think those are the three that I'm looking forward to the most.
Yeah, already seeing Spider-Verse showing up in the chat. I'm really looking forward to this Ben Affleck directed Air Nike movie about pitching Michael Jordan on being their spokesperson. The trailer does not really do it for me, but Ben Affleck as a director has only made one movie that I didn't think was great. And I still think that movie is more watchable than most critics did.
Mm-hmm.
So Ben Affleck directing again, that is exciting to me. And mm-hmm. then hopefully at Sin Week, John Wick 4, because my boy Donnie Yen is in that movie. And it's also a John Wick movie, and everything will be dialed up to 14 or 15 by now. I think the second movie dialed it up to 11. So
yeah,
definitely looking forward to that. The trailer was insane. All right. I think that's probably going to do it for today.
Yep. That'll do it for today. Next week is Strange Days. Once again, would like to thank everybody in chat, for coming out today and watching us, do this thing. Really appreciate it. So we'll see you next time.
See you. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/CinemaSins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@CinemaSins.com. That's recotopia@CinemaSins.com.
Hey.
Hey, what's up?
What's up?
What's going on?
What's up and stuff? Especially Chad's. No dangling Chad's. Have you, in the past week, seen any Tennessee license plates that don't have a B in them?
No, and unfortunately, I wasn't looking carefully. Hold on a second, I'm sorry.
God. I didn't expect you to, have a tally for me.
I went to Savannah over the weekend. I would tried to remind myself to look at Tennessee license plates when we were in Tennessee, and I only caught, when I was actually paying attention to it, caught one, and it had a B in it, so I was like, all right.
That proves my theory.
Yep, pretty much.
My parents went there, and I've never been. I've heard it's rad.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a nice little... You know, nice small town with, you know, very distinct features, popularized, of course, by the Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. But yeah, you walk around and it's just like, I don't know. It's just very, it's very cool. It's a nice little place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I've heard. I think the last trip I made, I don't remember. Probably when I drove to Memphis for trying to promote one of my books on the TV show. I hated that day.
What because of going down there or because of the promotion itself?
Well, it's the first... The TV thing was fine. It's just I had never made that drive before, and I hate it
it's
now
brutal.
Because... And the drive to Chattanooga and Knoxville is at least, scenic. There are parts on the drive to Knoxville that are just downright gorgeous. And there's none of that on the way to Memphis. No. And so then I do this TV interview, and then the promoter had scheduled a radio interview for 4 hours after that. So I had to just do stuff in Memphis. I went to that hotel and tried to see the ducks, did the thing where they walk from the fountain to the Peabody. Are you familiar with this? Anyway, they have this guy who comes out and gives the history of the ducks and blows a whistle or something, and the ducks all march down into the elevator, and then they go up on the roof. And I ate brunch, and then I just read in the library for 3 hours before my interview. Then the drive back, just as brutal, but during rush hour.
Yeah, it's painful. If you're 60 miles within Atlanta, that's where you start seeing just jaw-dropping speeds coming through the interstate, and I sort of put my resolve in to just say I'm going to pick a lane, I'm going to stay there, I'm going to drive a certain speed that will not be the what everybody wants, but you guys got to go around me, and I'm not going to try to go a speed that I might have to get into another lane and pass somebody else at some point. I'm fine driving. What is the speed limit in Atlanta is more, it's like you driving 35 miles an hour, I think. And these cars, man, there's cars that are seriously racing each other, for real racing each other. And I don't think they know each other. They're just you've got a car that's going fast. I got a car that's going fast. Let's see who wins, quote unquote, this race, which there's no winner. There's no prize to be had. There's maybe maybe talking to your buddies afterwards and say, that car tried to pass me and I didn't let him. But
yeah, I've seen stuff like that, but not, I don't think that bad, that fast.
It's
but
a Sunday night.
It's starting to happen.
Where you gotta be? It's a Sunday fucking night.
Yeah. When I was in college, we were 50 miles from Chicago. And so the cool thing to do was to go to Chicago and do something awesome.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it's like now, because that was almost 30 years ago. But at the time, once you got on the loop, Chicago, virtually every car is going 90 plus miles an hour, and you have to do that or you will be killed. And it scared the shit out of me the first, maybe my whole freshman year, but eventually it just became automatic. I remember I took a date to Chicago my junior year, and she had never been on the loop, and it freaked her the hell out. I was like, oh, this is nothing. I've been doing this for 3 years now. That's probably the scariest driving I've ever been in. I hear Boston is bad, but I haven't driven in Boston.
That's something that we get in our heads, though, that we have to maintain the speed everybody else does, or else we'll get run over or something like that. And I'm like, I'm sorry. If I go a speed that I desire, you're just going to have to go around me. And that's what's ended up being the psychology of it was I could go faster, but it's not going to be fast enough for you. It's just not. So why not just go a speed that's safe? And then when you see that you're about to, that you're coming, you're closing the distance between you and me really fast, you just get into another lane because that's what you were going to do anyway. So why don't we just dispense with the bull here and just, you know, so yeah, man, I was just driving the speed limit and I felt like I was driving really slow, but I was not driving slow.